Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Chapter 10 of G.K. Chesterton's Charles Dickens. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. G.K. Chesterton's Charles Dickens. Chapter 10. The Great Dickens Characters. All criticism tends too much to become criticism of criticism, and the reason is very evident. It is that criticism of creation is so very staggering a thing. We see this in the difficulty of criticizing any artistic creation. We see it again in the difficulty of criticizing that creation which is spelt with a capital C. The pessimists who attack the universe are always under this disadvantage. They have an exhilarating consciousness that they could make the sun and moon better, but they also have the depressing consciousness that they could not have made the sun and moon at all. A man looking at a hippopotamus may sometimes be tempted to regard a hippopotamus as an enormous mistake, but he is also bound to confess that a fortunate inferiority prevents him personally from making such mistakes. It is neither a blasphemy nor an exaggeration to say that we feel something of the same difficulty in judging of the very creative element in human literature. And this is the first and last dignity of Dickens, that he was a creator. He did not point out things, he made them. We may disapprove of Mr. Guppy, but we recognize him as a creation flung down like a miracle out of an upper sphere. We can pull him to pieces, but we could not have put him together. We can destroy Mrs. Gamp in our wrath, but we could not have made her in our joy. Under this disadvantage, any book about Dickens must definitely labor. Real primary creation, such as the sun or the birth of a child, calls forth not criticism, not appreciation, but a kind of incoherent gratitude. This is why most hymns about God are bad, and this is why most eulogies on Dickens are bad. The eulogists of the divine and of the human creator are alike inclined to appear sentimentalists, because they are talking about something as very real. In the same way, love letters always sound florid and artificial, because they are about something real. Any chapter such as this chapter must therefore, in a sense, be inadequate. There is no way of dealing properly with the ultimate greatness of Dickens, except by offering sacrifice to him as a god, and this is opposed to the etiquette of our time. But something can perhaps be done in the way of suggesting what was the quality of this creation. But even in considering its quality, we ought to remember that quality is not the whole question. One of the godlike things about Dickens is his quantity. His quantity as such, the enormous output, the incredible fecundity of his invention. I have said a moment ago that not one of us could have invented Mr. Guppy. But even if we could have stolen Mr. Guppy from Dickens, we have still to confront the fact that Dickens would have been able to invent another quite inconceivable character to take his place. Perhaps we could have created Mr. Guppy, but the effort would certainly have exhausted us. We should be ever afterwards wheeled about in a bath chair at Bournemouth. Nevertheless, there is something that is worth saying about the quality of Dickens. At the very beginning of this review, I remarked that the reader must be in a mood, at least, of democracy. To some it may have sounded irrelevant, but the Revolution was as much behind all the books of the 19th century as the Catholic religion, let us say, was behind all the colors and carvings of the Middle Ages. Another great name of the 19th century will afford an evidence of this, and will also bring us most sharply to the problem of the literary quality of Dickens. Of all these 19th century writers, there is none, in the noblest sense, more democratic than Walter Scott. As this may be disputed, and as it is relevant, I will expand the remark. There are two rooted spiritual realities out of which grow all kinds of democratic conception or sentiment of human quality. There are two things in which all men are manifestly and unmistakably equal. They are not equally clever, or equally muscular, or equally fat, as the sages of the modern reaction, with piercing insight, perceive. But this is a spiritual certainty, that all men are tragic. And this, again, is an equally sublime spiritual certainty, that all men are comic. No special and private sorrow can be so dreadful as the fact of having to die, and no freak or deformity can be so funny as the mere fact of having two legs. Every man is important if he loses his life, and every man is funny if he loses his hat and has to run after it. And the universal test everywhere of whether a thing is popular of the people is whether it employs vigorously these extremes of the tragic and the comic. Shelley, for instance, was an aristocrat, if ever there was one in the world. He was a republican, but he was not a democrat. In his poetry, there is every perfect quality except this pungent and popular stab. For the tragic and the comedy, you must go, say, to Burns, a poor man. And all over the world, the folk literature, the popular literature, is the same. It consists of very dignified sorrow and very undignified fun. Its sad tales are of broken hearts. Its happy tales are of broken heads. These, I say, are two roots of democratic reality. But they have in more civilized literature a more civilized embodiment of form. In literature such as that of the 19th century, the two elements appear somewhat thus. Tragedy becomes a profound sense of human dignity. The other and jollier element becomes a delighted sense of human variety. The first supports equality by saying that all men are equally sublime. The second supports equality by observing that all men are equally interesting. In this democratic aspect of the interest and variety of all men, there is, of course, no democrat so great as Dickens. But in the other matter, in the idea of the dignity of all men, I repeat that there is no democrat so great as Scott. This fact, which is the moral and enduring magnificence of Scott, has been astonishingly overlooked. His rich and dramatic effects are gained in almost every case by some grotesque or beggarly figure rising into a human pride and rhetoric. The common man, in the sense of the paltry man, becomes the common man in the sense of the universal man. He declares his humanity, for the meanest of all the modernities has been the notion that the heroic is an oddity or variation, and that the things that unite us are merely flat or foul. The common things are terrible and startling, death, for instance, and first love. The things that are common are the things that are not commonplace. Into such high and central passions, the comic Scott character will suddenly rise. Remember the firm and almost stately answer of the preposterous Nicol Jarvie when Helen MacGregor seeks to browbeat him into condoning lawlessness and breaking his bourgeois decency. That speech is a great monument of the middle class. Molière made Monsieur Jourdain talk prose, but Scott made him talk poetry. Think of the rising and rousing voice of the dull and gluttonous Athelstane when he answers and overwhelms de Bracy. Think of the proud appeal of the old beggar in The Antiquary when he rebukes the duelists. Scott was fond of describing kings in disguise, but all his characters are kings in disguise. He was, with all his errors, profoundly possessed with an old religious conception, the only possible democratic basis, the idea that man himself is a king in disguise. In all this, Scott, though a royalist and a Tory, had in the strangest way the heart of the revolution. For instance, he regarded rhetoric, the art of the orator, as the immediate weapon of the oppressed. All his poor men make grand speeches, as they did in the Jacobin Club, which Scott would have so much detested. And it is odd to reflect that he was, as an author, giving free speech to fictitious rebels, while he was, as a stupid politician, denying it to real ones. But the point for us here is that all this popular sympathy of his rests on the graver basis, on the dark dignity of man. "Can you find no way?" asks Sir Arthur Wardour of the beggar when they are cut off by the tide. "I'll give you a farm, I'll make you rich." "Our riches will soon be equal," says the beggar, and looks out across the advancing sea. Now I have dwelt on this strong point of Scott because it is the best illustration of the one weak point of Dickens. Dickens had little or none of this sense of the concealed sublimity of every separate man. Dickens's sense of democracy was entirely of the other kind. It rested on the other of the two supports of which I have spoken. It rested on the sense that all men were wildly interesting and wildly varied. When a Dickens character becomes excited, he becomes more and more himself. He does not, like the Scott beggar, turn more and more into man. As he rises, he grows more and more into a gargoyle or grotesque. He does not, like the fine speaker in Scott, grow more classical as he grows more passionate, more universal as he grows more intense. The thing can only be illustrated by a special case. Dickens did more than once, of course, make one of his quaint or humble characters assert himself in a serious crisis, or defy the powerful. There is, for instance, the quite admirable scene in which Susan Nipper, one of the greatest of Dickens's achievements, faces and rebukes Mr. Dombey. But it is still true, and quite appropriate in its own place and manner, that Susan Nipper remains a purely comic character throughout her speech, and even grows more comic as she goes on. She is more serious than usual in her meaning, but not more serious in her style. Dickens keeps the natural diction of Nipper, but makes her grow more nipperish as she grows more warm. But Scott keeps the natural diction of Bailey Jarvie, but insensibly sobers and uplifts the style until it reaches a plain and appropriate eloquence. This plain and appropriate eloquence was, except in a few places at the end of Pickwick, almost unknown to Dickens. Whenever he made comic characters talk sentiment comically, as in the instance of Susan, it was a success, but an avowedly extravagant success. Whenever he made comic characters talk sentiment seriously, it was an extravagant failure. Humor was his medium, his only way of approaching emotion. Wherever you do not get humor, you get unconscious humor. As I have said elsewhere in this book, Dickens was deeply and radically English, the most English of our great writers. And there was something very English in this contentment with a grotesque democracy, and in this absence of the eloquence and elevation of Scott. The English democracy is the most humorous democracy in the world. The Scotch democracy is the most dignified, while the whole abandoned and satiric genius of the English populace come from its being quite undignified in every way. A comparison of the two types can be found, for instance, by putting a Scotch labor leader like Mr. Keir Hardie alongside an English labor leader like Mr. Will Crooks. Both are good men, honest and responsible and compassionate, but we can feel that the Scotchman carries himself seriously and universally, the Englishman personally and with an obstinate humor. Mr. Keir Hardie wishes to hold up his head as man. Mr. Crooks wishes to follow his nose as Crooks. Mr. Keir Hardie is very like a poor man in Walter Scott. Mr. Crooks is very much like a poor man in Dickens. Dickens then had this English feeling of a grotesque democracy. But that is more properly meant a vastly varying democracy. The intoxicating variety of men, that was his vision and conception of human brotherhood, and certainly it is a great part of human brotherhood. In one sense, things can only be equal if they are entirely different. Thus, for instance, people talk with a quite astonishing gravity about the inequality or equality of the sexes, as if there could possibly be any inequality between a lock and a key. Wherever there is no element of variety, wherever all the items literally have an identical aim, there is at once and of necessity inequality. A woman is only inferior to man in the matter of being not so manly. She is inferior in nothing else. Man is inferior to woman in so far as he is not a woman. There is no other reason. And the same applies in some degree to all genuine differences. It is a great mistake to suppose that love unites and unifies men. Love diversifies them, because love is directed toward individuality. The thing that really unites men and makes them like to each other is hatred. Thus, for instance, the more we love Germany, the more pleased we shall be that Germany should be something different from ourselves, should keep her own ritual and conviviality, and we ours. But the more we hate Germany, the more we shall copy German guns and German fortifications in order to be armed against Germany. The more modern nations detest each other, the more meekly they follow each other, for all competition is in its nature only a furious plagiarism. As competition means always similarity, it is equally true that similarity always means inequality. If everything is trying to be green, some things will be greener than others. But there is an immortal and indestructible equality between green and red. Something of the same kind of irrefutable equality exists between the violent and varying creations of such a writer as Dickens. They are all equally ecstatic fulfillments of a separate line of development. It would be hard to say that there could be any comparison or inequality, let us say, between Mr. Sapsea and Mr. Elijah Pogram. They are both in the same difficulty. They can neither of them contrive to exist in this world. They are both too big for the gate of birth. Of the high virtue of this variation, I shall speak more adequately in a moment. But certainly this love of mere variation, which I have contrasted with the classicism of Scott, is the only intelligent statement of the common case against the exaggeration of Dickens. This is the meaning, the only sane or endurable meaning, which people have in their minds when they say that Dickens is a mere caricaturist. They do not mean merely that Uncle Pumblechook does not exist. A fictitious character ought not to be a person who exists. He ought to be an entirely new combination, an addition to the creatures already existing on the earth. They do not mean that Uncle Pumblechook could not exist, for on that, obviously, they can have no knowledge whatever. They do not mean that Uncle Pumblechook's utterances are selected and arranged so as to bring out his essential Pumblechookery. To say that is simply to say that he occurs in a work of art. But what they do really mean is this, and there is an element of truth in it. They mean that Dickens nowhere makes the reader feel that Pumblechook has any kind of fundamental human dignity at all. It is nowhere suggested that Pumblechook will someday die. He is rather as one of the idle and evil fairies, who are innocuous and yet malignant, and who live forever because they never really live at all. This dehumanized vitality, this fantasy, this irresponsibility of creation, does in some sense truly belong to Dickens. It is the lower side of his hilarious human variety. But now we come to the higher side of his human variety, and it is far more difficult to state. Mr. George Gissing, from the point of view of the passing intellectualism of our day, has made, among his many wise tributes to Dickens, a characteristic complaint about him. He has said that Dickens, with all his undoubted sympathy for the lower classes, never made a working man, a poor man, specifically and highly intellectual. An exception does exist, which he must at least have realized, a wit, a diplomatist, a great philosopher. I mean, of course, Mr. Weller. Broadly, however, the accusation has a truth, though it is a truth that Mr. Gissing did not grasp in its entirety. It is not only true that Dickens seldom made a poor character what we call intellectual, it is also true that he seldom made any character what we call intellectual. Intellectualism was not at all present to his imagination. What was present to his imagination was character, a thing which is not only more important than intellect, but is also much more entertaining. when some English moralists write about the importance of having character, they appear to mean only the importance of having a dull character. But character is brighter than wit, and much more complex than sophistry. The whole superiority of the democracy of Dickens over the democracy of such a man as Gissing lies exactly in the fact that Gissing would have liked to prove that poor men could instruct themselves and could instruct others. It was of final importance to Dickens that poor men could amuse themselves and could amuse him. He troubled little about the mere education of that life. He declared two essential things about it, that it was laughable and that it was livable. The humble characters of Dickens do not amuse each other with epigrams, they amuse each other with themselves. The present that each man brings in hand is his own incredible personality. In the most sacred sense, and in the most literal sense of the phrase, he gives himself away. Now the man who gives himself away does the last act of generosity. He is like a martyr, a lover, or a monk. But he is also, almost certainly, what we commonly call a fool. The key of the great characters of Dickens is that they are all great fools. There is the same difference between a great fool and a small fool as there is between a great poet and a small poet. The great fool is a being who is above wisdom, rather than below it. That element of greatness of which I spoke at the beginning of this book is nowhere more clearly indicated than in such characters. A man can be entirely great while he is entirely foolish. We see this in the epic heroes, such as Achilles. Nay, a man can be entirely great because he is entirely foolish. We see this in all the great comic characters of all the great comic writers of whom Dickens was the last. Bottom the Weaver is great because he is foolish. Mr. Toots is great because he is foolish. The thing I mean can be observed, for instance, in innumerable actual characters. Which of us has not known, for instance, a great rustic, a character so incurably characteristic that he seemed to break through all canons about cleverness or stupidity? We do not know whether he is an enormous idiot or an enormous philosopher. We know only that he is enormous, like a hill. These great grotesque characters are almost entirely to be found where Dickens found them, among the poorer classes. The gentry only attain this greatness by going slightly mad. But who has not known an unfathomably personal old nurse? Who has not known an abysmal butler? The truth is that our public life consists almost exclusively of small men. Our public men are small because they have to prove that they are in the commonplace interpretation clever, because they have to pass examinations to learn codes of manner to imitate a fixed type. It is in private life that we find the great characters. They are too great to get into the public world. It is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a great man to enter into the kingdoms of the earth. The truly great and gorgeous personality, he who talks as no one else could talk and feels with an elementary fire, you will never find this man on any cabinet bench, in any literary circle, at any society dinner. Least of all will you find him in artistic society. He is utterly unknown in Bohemia. He is more than clever, he is amusing. He is more than successful, he is alive. You will find him stranded here and there in all sorts of unknown positions, almost always in unsuccessful positions. You will find him adrift as an impecunious commercial traveler like Micawber. You will find him but one of a batch of silly clerks like Swiveller. You will find him as an unsuccessful actor like Crumless. You will find him an unsuccessful doctor like Sawyer. But you will always find this rich and reeking personality where Dickens found it, among the poor. For the glory of this world is a very small and priggish affair, and these men are too large to get in line with it. They are too strong to conquer. It is impossible to do justice to these figures, because the essential of them is their multiplicity. The whole point of Dickens is that he not only made them, but made them by myriads, that he stamped his foot and armies came out of the earth. But let us, for the sake of showing the true Dickens method, take one of them, a very sublime one, Toots. It affords a good example of the real work of Dickens. which was the revealing of a certain grotesque greatness inside an obscure and even unattractive type. It reveals the great paradox of all spiritual things, that the inside is always larger than the outside. Toots is a type that we all know as well as we know chimney pots, and of all conceivable human figures, he is apparently the most futile and the most dull. He is the blockhead who hangs on at a private school, overgrown and underdeveloped. He is always backward in his lessons, but forward in certain cheap ways of the world. He can smoke before he can spell. Toots is a perfect and pungent figure of the wretched youth. Toots has, as this youth always has, a little money of his own, enough to waste in a semi-dissipation he does not enjoy, and in a gaping regard for sports in which he could not possibly excel. Toots has, as this youth always has, bits of surreptitious finery, in his case the incomparable ring. In Toots, above all, is exactly rendered the central and most startling contradiction, the contrast between a jauntiness and a certain impudence of the attire, with the profound shame and sheepishness of the visage and the character. In him, too, is expressed the larger contrast between the external gaiety of such a lad's occupations and the infinite, disconsolate sadness of his empty eyes. This is Toots. We know him, we pity him, and we avoid him. Schoolmasters deal with him in despair or in a heartbreaking patience. His family is vague about him. His low-class hangers-on, like the game chicken, lead him by the nose. The very parasites that live on him despise him, but Dickens does not despise him. Without denying one of the dreary details which make us avoid the man, Dickens makes him a man whom we long to meet. He does not gloss over one of his dismal deficiencies, but he makes them seem suddenly like violent virtues that we would go to the world's end to see. Without altering one fact, he manages to alter the whole atmosphere, the whole universe of Toots. He makes us not only like, but love, not only love, but reverence this little dunce and cad. The power to do this is a power truly and literally to be called divine. For this is the very wholesome point. Dickens does not alter Toots in any vital point. The thing he does alter is us. He makes us lively where we were bored, kind where we were cruel, and above all, free for an universal human laughter, where we were cramped in a small competition about that sad and solemn tiling, the intellect. His enthusiasm fills us, as does the love of God, with a glorious shame. After all, he has only found in Toots what we might have found for ourselves. He has only made us as interested in Toots as Toots is in himself. He does not alter the proportions of Toots, he alters only the scale. We seem as if we were staring at a rat risen to the stature of an elephant. Hitherto we could have passed him by. Now we feel that nothing could induce us to pass him by. That is the nearest way to putting the truth. He has not been whitewashed in the least. He has not been depicted as any cleverer than he is. He has been turned from a small fool into a great fool. We know Toots is not clever, but we are not inclined to quarrel with Toots because he is not clever. We are more likely to quarrel with cleverness because it is not Toots. All the examinations he could not pass, all the schools he could not enter, all the temporary tests of brain and culture which surrounded him shall pass, and Toots shall remain like a mountain. It may be noticed that the great artists always choose great fools rather than great intellectuals to embody humanity. Hamlet does express the aesthetic dreams and the bewilderments of the intellect, but Bottom the Weaver expresses them much better. In the same manner, Toots expresses certain permanent dignities in human nature more than any of Dickens's more dignified characters can do it. For instance, Toots expresses admirably the enduring fear, which is the very essence of falling in love. When Toots is invited by Florence to come in, when he longs to come in but still stays out, he is embodying a sort of insane and perverse humility, which is elementary in the lover. There is an apostolic injunction to suffer fools gladly. We always lay the stress on the word suffer and interpret the passage as one urging resignation. It might be better, perhaps, to lay the stress on the word gladly, and make our familiarity with fools a delight, and almost a dissipation. Nor is it necessary that our pleasure in fools, or at least in great and godlike fools, should be merely satiric or cruel. The great fool is he in whom we cannot tell which is the conscious and which is the unconscious humor. We laugh with him and laugh at him at the same time. An obvious instance is that of ordinary and happy marriage. A man and a woman cannot live together without having against each other a kind of everlasting joke. Each has discovered that the other is a fool, but a great fool. This largeness, this grossness and gorgeousness of folly, is the thing which we all find about those with whom we are in intimate contact, and it is the one enduring basis of affection, and even of respect. When we know an individual named Tompkins, we know that he has succeeded where all others have failed. He has succeeded in being Tompkins. Just so Mr. Toots succeeded. He was defeated in all scholastic examinations, but he was the victor in that visionary battle in which unknown competitors vainly tried to be Toots. If we are to look for lessons, here at least is the last and deepest lesson of Dickens. It is in our own daily life that we are to look for the portents and the prodigies. This is the truth not merely of the fixed figures of our life, the wife, the husband, the fool that fills the sky. It is true of the whole stream and substance of our daily experience. Every instant we reject a great fool merely because he is foolish. Every day we neglect Tootses and Swivelers, Guppies and Joblings, Simmeries and Flashers. Every day we lose the last sight of Jobling and Chuckster, the analytical chemist, or the marchioness. Every day we are missing a monster whom we might easily love, and an imbecile whom we should certainly admire. This is the real gospel of Dickens, the inexhaustible opportunities offered by the liberty and the variety of man. Compared with this life, all public life, all fame, all wisdom, is by its nature cramped and cold and small. For on that defined and lighted public stage, men are of necessity forced to profess one set of accomplishments, to rise to one rigid standard. It is the utterly unknown people who can grow in all directions like an exuberant tree. It is in our interior lives that we find that people are too much themselves. It is in our private life that we find them swelling into the enormous contours and taking on the colors of caricature. Many of us live publicly with featureless public puppets, images of the small public abstractions. It is when we pass our own private gate and open our own secret door that we step into the land of the giants. End of chapter 10. Recording by Tisto, TYSTO.com.
Chapter 11 of Charles Dickens by G. K. Chesterton. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Dick Durrett. Chapter 11. On the alleged optimism of Dickens. In one of the plays of the decadent period, an intellectual expressed the atmosphere of his epoch by referring to Dickens as a vulgar optimist. I have in previous chapter suggested something of the real strangeness of such a term. After all, the main matter of astonishment, or rather of admiration, is that optimism should be vulgar. In a world in which physical distress is almost a common lot, we actually complain that happiness is too common. In a world in which the majority is physically miserable, we actually complain of the sameness of praise. We are bored with the abundance of approval. When we consider that the conditions of the vulgar really are, it is difficult to imagine a stranger or more splendid tribute to humanity than such a phrase as vulgar optimism. It is as if one spoke of vulgar martyrdom or common crucifixion. First, however, let it be said frankly that there is a foundation for the charge against Dickens, which is implied in the phrase about vulgar optimism. It does not concern itself with Dickens's confidence in the value of existence and the intrinsic victory of virtue. That is not optimism, but religion. It is not concerned with his habit of making bright occasions bright and happy stories happy. That is not optimism, but literature. Nor is it concerned even with his peculiar genius for the description of an almost bloated joviality. That is not optimism, it is simply Dickens. With all these higher variations of optimism, I deal elsewhere. But over and above all these, there is a real sense in which Dickens laid himself open to the accusation of a vulgar optimism, and I desire to put the admission of this first before the discussion that follows. Dickens did have a disposition to make his characters at all costs happy, or, to speak more strictly, he had a disposition to make them comfortable rather than happy. He had a sort of literary hospitality. He too often treated his characters as if they were his guests. From a host is always expected and always ought to be expected, as long as human civilization is healthy, a strictly physical benevolence, if you will, a kind of coarse benevolence. Food and fire and such things should always be the symbols of the man entertaining men, because they are things which all men beyond question have in common. But something more than this is needed from a man who is imagining and making men, the artist, the man who is not receiving men, but rather sending them forth. As I shall remark in a moment in the matter of the Dickens villains, it is not true that he made everyone thus at home, but he did do it in a certain wide class of incongruous characters. He did it to all who had been in any way unfortunate. It had needed its origin, a very beautiful origin, in his realization of how much a little pleasure was to such people. He knew well that the greatest happiness that had been known since Eden is the happiness of the unhappy. So far he is admirable, and as long as he was describing the ecstasy of the poor, the borderland between pain and pleasure, he was at his highest. Nothing that has ever been written about the human delights, no earthly paradise, no utopia, has ever come so near the quick nerve of happiness as his descriptions of the rare extravagances of the poor, such as admirable description, for instance, as that of Kit Nubbles taking his family to the theatre. For he seizes on the real source of the whole pleasure, a holy fear. Kit tells the waiter to bring the beer, and the waiter, instead of saying, "Did you address that language to me?" said, "Pot of beer, sir." "Yes, sir." That internal and quivering humility of Kit is the only way to enjoy life or banquets, and the fear of the waiter is the beginning of dining. People in this mood take their pleasures sadly, which is the only way of taking them at all. So far, Dickens is supremely right. As long as he was dealing with such penury and such festivity, his touch was almost invariably sure. But when he came to more difficult cases, to people who for one reason or another could not be cured with one good dinner, he did develop this other evil, this genuinely vulgar optimism of which I speak. And the mark of it is this, that he gave the characters a comfort that had no especial connection with themselves. He threw comfort at them like alms. There are cases at the end of his stories in which his kindness to his characters is a careless and insolent kindness. He loses his real charity and adopts the charity of the Charity Organization Society, the charity that is not kind, the charity that is puffed up, and that does behave itself unseemly. At the end of some of his stories, he deals out his characters a kind of outdoor relief. I will give you two instances. The whole meaning of the character of Mr. Micawber is that a man can be always almost rich by constantly expecting riches. The lesson is a really important one in our sweeping modern sociology. We talk of the man whose life is a failure, but Micawber's life never is a failure because it is always a crisis. We think constantly of the man, if he looked back, would see that his existence was unsuccessful, but Micawber never does look back. He always looks forward, because the bailiff is coming tomorrow. You cannot say he is defeated, for his absurd battle never ends. He cannot despair of life, for he is so much occupied in living. All this is of immense importance in the understanding of the poor. It is worth all the alum novelists that ever insulted democracy. But how did it happen that the man who created this Micawber could pension his off at the end of the story and make him a successful colonial mayor? Micawber never did succeed, never ought to succeed. His kingdom is not of this world. But this is an excellent instance of Dickens's disposition to make his characters grossly and incongruously comfortable. There is another instance in the same book. Dora, the first wife of David Copperfield, is a very genuine and amusing figure. She has certainly far more force of character than Agnes. She represents the infinite and divine irrationality of the human heart. What possessed Dickens to make her such a dehumanized prig as to recommend her husband to marry another woman? One could easily respect a husband who, after time and development, made such a marriage, but surely not a wife who desired it. If Dora had died hating Agnes, we should know that everything was right, and that God would reconcile the irreconcilable. When Dora dies, recommended Agnes, we know that everything is wrong, at least if hypocrisy and artificiality and moral vulgarity are wrong. There again, Dickens yields to a mere desire to give comfort. He wishes to pile up pillows around Dora, and he smothers her with them like Othello. This is the real vulgar optimism of Dickens. It does exist, and I have deliberately put it first. Let us admit that Dickens's mind was far too much filled with pictures of satisfaction and coziness and repose. Let us admit that he thought principally of the pressures of the oppressed classes. Let us admit that it hardly cost him any artistic pang to make out human beings as such happier than they are. Let us admit all this, and a curious fact remains. for it was this too easily contented Dickens, this man with cushions at his back, and it sometimes seems cotton wool in his ears, it was this happy dreamer, this vulgar optimist, who alone of modern writers did really destroy some of the wrongs he hated and bring about some of the reforms he desired. Dickens did help to pull down the debtors' prisons, and if he was too much of an optimist, he was quite enough of a destroyer. Dickens did drive Squeers out of his Yorkshire den, and if Dickens was too contented, it was more than Squeers was. Dickens did leave his mark on parochialism, on nursing, on funerals, on public executions, on workhouses, on the Court of Chancery. These things were altered. They are different. It may be that such reforms are not adequate remedies. That is another question altogether. The next sociologist may think these old radical reforms quite narrow or accidental. But such as they were, the old radicals got them done, and a new sociologist cannot get anything done at all. And in the practical doing of them, Dickens played a solid and quite demonstrable part. That is, the plain matter that concerns us here. If Dickens was an optimist, he was an uncommonly active and useful kind of optimist. If Dickens was a sentimentalist, he was a very practical sentimentalist. And the reason of this is one that goes deep into Dickens's social reform, and like every other real and desirable thing, involves a kind of mystical contradiction. If we are to save the oppressed, we must have two apparently antagonistic emotions in us at the same time. We must think the oppressed man intensely miserable, and at the same time intensely attractive and important. We must insist that violence upon his degradation. We must insist with the same violence upon his dignity. For if we relax by one inch the one assertion, men will say he does not need saving. And if we relax by one inch the other assertion, men will say he is not worth saving. The optimist will say that reform is needless. The pessimist will say that reform is hopeless. We must apply both simultaneously to the same oppressed man. We must say that he is a worm and a god, and we must thus lay ourselves open to the accusation or the compliment of transcendentalism. This is indeed the strongest argument for the religious conception of life. If the dignity of man is an earthly dignity, we shall be tempted to deny his earthly degradation. If it is a heavenly dignity, we can admit the earthly degradation with all the candor of Zola. If we are idealists about the other world, we can be realists about this world. But that is not here the point. What is quite evident is that if a logical praise of the poor man is pushed too far, and if a logical distress about him is pushed too far, either will improve wreckage to the central paradox of reform. If a poor man is made too admirable, he ceases to be pitiable. If the poor man is made too pitiable, he becomes merely contemptible. There is a school of smug optimists who will deny that he is a poor man. There is a school of scientific pessimists who will deny that he is a man. Out of this perennial contradiction arises the fact that there are always two types of the reformer. The first we may call for convenience the pessimistic, the second the optimistic reformer. One dwells upon the fact that souls are being lost, the other dwells upon the fact that they are worth saving. Both, of course, are, so far as that is concerned, quite right, but they naturally tend to a difference of method, and sometimes to a difference of perception. The pessimistic reformer points out the good elements that oppression has destroyed. The optimist reformer, with an even fiercer joy, points out the good elements that it has not destroyed. It is the case for the first reformer that slavery has made men slavish. It is the case for the second reformer that slavery has not made men slavish. The first describes how bad men are under bad conditions. The second describes how good men are under bad conditions. Of the first class of writers, for instance, is Gorky. Of the second class of writers is Dickens. But here we must register a real and somewhat startling fact. In the face of all apparent probability, it is certainly true that the optimistic reformer reforms much more completely than the pessimistic reformer. People produce violent changes by being contented, by being far too contented. The man who said that revolutions are not made with rose water was obviously inexperienced in practical human affairs. Men like Rousseau and Shelley do make revolutions, and do make them with rose water, that is, with a too rosy and sentimental view of human goodness, figures that come before and create convulsions and change, for instance, the central figure of the New Testament, always have the air of walking in an unnatural sweetness and calm. They give us their peace ultimately in blood and battle and division. Not as the world giveth, give they unto us. Nor is the real reason of the triumph of the too-contented reformer particularly difficult to define. He triumphs because he keeps alive in the human soul an invincible sense of the thing being worth doing, of the war being worth winning, of the people being worth their deliverance. I remember that Mr. William Archer, some time ago, published in one of his interesting series of interviews an interview with Mr. Thomas Hardy. That powerful writer was represented as saying, in the course of the conversation, that he did not wish at the particular moment to define his opinion with regard to the ultimate problem of whether life itself was worth living. There are, he said, hundreds of remediable evils in this world. When we have remedied all these, such was his argument, it will be time enough to ask whether existence itself, under its best possible conditions, is valuable or desirable. Here we have presented, with a considerable element of what can only be called unconscious humor, the plain reason of the failure of the pessimist as a reformer. Mr. Hardy is asking us, I will not say to buy a pig in a poke, he is asking as to buy a poke on the remote chance of there being a pig in it. When we have for some few frantic centuries tortured ourselves to save mankind, it will then be time enough to discuss whether they can possibly be saved. When, in the case of infant mortality, for example, we have exhausted ourselves with the earth-shaking efforts required to save the life of every individual baby, it will then be time enough to consider whether every individual baby would not have been happier dead. We are to remove mountains and bring the millennium, because then we have a quiet moment to discuss whether the millennium is at all desirable. Here we have the low water mark of the impotence of the sad reformer, and here we have the reason of the paradoxical triumph of the happy one. His triumph is a religious triumph. It rests upon the perpetual assertion of the value of the human soul and of human daily life. It rests upon his assertion that human life is enjoyable because it is human. And he will never admit, like so many compassionate pessimists, that human life ever ceases to be human. He does not merely pity the lowness of men, he feels an insult to their elevation. Brute pity should be given only to brutes. Cruelty to animals is cruelty and a vile thing, but cruelty to a man is not cruelty, it is treason. Tyranny over a man is not tyranny, it is rebellion, for man is royal. Now, the practical weakness of the vast mass of modern pity for the poor and the oppressed is precisely that it is merely pity. The pity is pitiful, but not respectful. Men feel that the cruelty to the poor is a kind of cruelty to animals. They never feel that it is justice to equals, nay, it is treachery to comrades. This dark scientific pity, this brutal pity, has an element in sincerity of its own, but it is entirely useless for all ends of social reform. Democracy swept Europe with a saber when it was founded upon the rights of man. It has done literally nothing at all since it has been founded only upon the wrongs of man. Or, more strictly speaking, its recent failure has been due to its not admitting the existence of any rights or wrongs or a deed of any humanity. Evolution, the sinister minister of revolution, does not especially deny the existence of God. What it does deny is the existence of man, and all the despair about the poor and the cold and repugnant pity for them. It has largely due to the vague sense that they have literally relapsed into the state of the lower animals. A writer sufficiently typical of recent revolutionism, Gorky, has called one of his books by the eerie and effective title, Creatures That Once Were Man. That title explains the whole failure of the Russian Revolution, and the reason why the English writers, such as Dickens, did with all their limitations achieve so many of the actual things at which they aimed was that they could not possibly have put such a title upon a human book. Dickens really helped the unfortunate in the matters to which he set himself, and the reason is that across all his books and sketches about the unfortunate might be written the common title, Creatures That Still Are Men. There does exist, then, this strange optimistic reformer, the man whose work begins with approval and ends with earthquake. Jesus Christ was destined to found a faith which made the rich poorer and the poor rich, but even when he was going to enrich them, he began with a phrase, Blessed are the poor. The Gissings and the Gorkies say, as a universal literary motto, Cursed are the poor. Among a million who have faintly followed Christ in this divine contradiction, Dickens stands out especially. He said in all his reforming utterances, Cure poverty, but he said in all his actual descriptions, Blessed are the poor. He described their happiness, and men rushed to remove their sorrow. He described them as human, and men resented the insults to their humanity. It is not difficult to see why, as I said at an earlier stage of this book, Dickens's denunciations have had so much more practical an effect than the denunciations of such a man as Gissing. Both agreed that the souls of the people were in a kind of prison, but Gissing said that the prison was full of dead souls. Dickens said that the prison was full of living souls, and the fiery cavalcade of rescuers felt that they had not come too late. Of this general fact about Dickens's descriptions of poverty, there will not, I suppose, be any serious dispute. The dispute will only be about the truth of these descriptions. It is clear that whereas Gissing would say, See how their poverty depresses the Smiths or the Browns. Dickens says, see how little, after all, their poverty can depress the Cratchits. No one will deny that he made a special feature of the poor. We will come to the discussion of the veracity of these scenes in a moment. It is here sufficient to register in conclusion of our examination of the reforming optimist that Dickens certainly was such an optimist, and that he made it his business to insist upon what happiness there is in the lives of the unhappy. His poor man is always a Mark Tapley, a man the optimism of whose spirit increases, if anything, with the pessimism of his experience. It can also be registered as a fact equally solid and quite equally demonstrable that this optimistic Dickens did effect great reforms. The reforms in which Dickens was instrumental were indeed, from the point of view of our sweeping social panaceas, special and limited. But perhaps for that reason especially, they afford a compact and concrete instance of the psychological paradox of which we speak. Dickens did definitely destroy, or at the very least help to destroy, certain institutions. He destroyed those institutions simply by describing them. But the crux and peculiarity of the whole matter is this, that, in a sense, it can be really be said that he described these things too optimistically. And in a real sense, he described Dotheboys Hall as a better place than it is. In a real sense, he made out the workhouse as a pleasanter place than it can ever be. For the chief glory of Dickens is that he made these places interesting, and the chief infamy of England is that it has made these places dull. Dullness was the thing that Dickens' genius could never succeed in describing. His vitality was so violent that he could not introduce into his books the genuine impression even of a moment of monotony. If there is anywhere in his novels in an instant of silence, we only hear more clearly the hero whispering with the heroine, the villain sharpening his dagger, or the creaking of the machinery that is to give out the god from the machine. He could splendidly describe gloomy places, but he could not describe dreary places. He could describe miserable marriages, but not monotonous marriages. It must have been genuinely entertaining to be married to Mr. Quilp. This sense of a still incessant excitement he spreads over every inch of his story and over every dark track of his landscape. His idea of a desolate place is a place where anything can happen. He has no idea of that desolate place where nothing can happen. This is a good thing for his soul, for the place where nothing can happen is hell. But still, it might reasonably be maintained by the modern mind that he is hampered in describing human evil and sorrow by this inability to imagine tedium, this dullness in the matter of dullness. For, after all, it is certainly true that the worst part of the lot of the unfortunate is the fact that they have long spaces in which to review the irrevocability of their doom. It is certainly true that the worst days of the oppressed man are the 9 days out of 10 in which he is not oppressed. This sense of sickness and sameness Dickens did certainly fail or refuse to give. When we read such a description as that excellent one, in detail, of Dotheboys Hall, we feel that, while everything else is accurate, the author does, in his words of the excellent Captain Nares in Stevenson's Wrecker, draw the dreariness rather mild. The boys at Dotheboys were perhaps less bullied but they were certainly more bored. For, indeed, how could anyone be bored with the society of so sumptuous a creature as Mr. Squeers? Who would not put up with a few illogical floggings in order to enjoy the conversation of a man who could say, "She's a rum 'un, is nature"? Nature is more easier conceived than described. The same principle applies to the workhouse in Oliver Twist. We feel vaguely that neither Oliver nor anyone else could be entirely unhappy in the presence of the purple personality of Mr. Bumble. The one thing he did not describe in any of the abuses he denounced was a soul-destroying potency of routine. He made out the bad school, the bad parochial system, the bad debtor's prison, as very much jollier and more exciting than they may really have been. In a sense, then, he flattered them, but he destroyed them with the flattery. By making Mrs. Gamp delightful, he made her impossible. He gave everyone an interest in Mr. Bumble's existence, and by the same act gave everyone an interest in his destruction. It would be difficult to find a stronger instance of the utility and energy of the method which we have, for the sake of argument, called the method of the optimistic reformer. As long as low Yorkshire schools were entirely colourless and dreary, they continued quietly tolerated by the public and quietly intolerable to the victims. So long as Squeers was dull as well as cruel, he was permitted. The moment he became amusing as well as cruel, he was destroyed. As long as Bumble was merely inhuman, he was allowed. When he became human, humanity wiped him right out. For in order to do these great acts of justice, we must always realize not only the humanity of the oppressed, but even the humanity of the oppressor. The satirist had, in a sense, to create the images in the mind before, as an iconoclast, he could destroy them. Dickens had to make Squeers live before he could make him die. In connection with the accusation of vulgar optimism, which I have taken as a text for this chapter, there is another somewhat odd thing to notice. Nobody in the world was ever less optimistic than Dickens in his treatment of evil or the evil man. When I say optimist in this matter, I mean optimism in the modern sense of an attempt to whitewash evil. Nobody ever made less attempt to whitewash evil than Dickens. Nobody black was ever less white than Dickens's black. He painted his villains and lost characters more black than they really are. He crowds his stories with a kind of villain rare in modern fiction, the villain really without any redeeming point. There is no redeeming point in Squeers, or in Monks, or in Ralph Nickleby, or in Bill Sykes, or in Quilp, or in Brass, or in Mr. Chester, or in Mr. Peckinniff, or in Jonas Chuzzlewit, or in Cracker, or in Uriah Heep, or in Blandois, or in 100 more. So far as the balance of good and evil in human characters is concerned, Dickens certainly could not be called a vulgar optimist. His emphasis on evil was melodramatic. He might be called a vulgar pessimist. Some will dismiss this lurid villainy as a detail of his artificial romance. I am not inclined to do so. He inherited undoubtedly this unqualified villain, as he inherited so many other things, from the whole history of European literature. But he breathed into the blackguard a peculiar and vigorous life of his own. He did not show any tendency to modify his blackguardism in accordance with the increasing considerateness of the age. He did not seem to wish to make his villain less villainous. He did not wish to imitate the analysis of George Eliot or the reverent skepticism of Thackeray. And all this works back, I think, to a real thing in him, that he wished to have an obstreperous and incalculable enemy. He wished to keep alive the idea of combat, which means, of necessity, a combat against something individual and alive. I do not know whether, in the kindly rationalism of his epoch, he kept any belief in a personal devil in his theology, but he certainly created a personal devil in every one of his books. A good example of my meaning can be found, for instance, in such a character as Quilp. Dickens may, for all I know, have had originally some idea of describing Quilp as the bitter and unhappy cripple, a deformity whose mind is stunted along with his body. But if he had such an idea, he soon abandoned it. Quilp is not in the least unhappy. His whole picturesqueness consists in the fact that he has a kind of hellish happiness, an atrocious hilarity that makes him go bounding about like an Indian rubber ball. Quilp is not in the least bitter. He has an unaffected gaiety and expansiveness and universality. He desires to hurt people in the same hearty way that a good-natured man desires to help them. He likes to poison people with the same kind of clamorous camaraderie with which an honest man likes to stand them drink. Quilp is not in the least stunted in mind. He is not in reality even stunted in body. His body, that is, does not in any way fall short of what he wants it to do. His smallness gives him rather the promptitude of a bird or the precipitance of a bullet. In a word, Quilp is precisely the devil of the Middle Ages. He belongs to that amazingly healthy period when even lost spirits were hilarious. This hardiness and vivacity in the villains of Dickens is worthy of note because it is directly connected with his own cheerfulness. This is a truth little understood in our time, but it is a very essential one. If optimism means a general approval, it is certainly true that the more a man becomes an optimist, the more he becomes a melancholy man. If he manages to praise everything, his praise will develop an alarming resemblance to a polite boredom. He will say that the marsh is as good as the garden. He will mean that the garden is as dull as the marsh. He may force himself to say that emptiness is good, but he would hardly prevent himself from asking, "What is the good of such good?" This optimism does exist. This optimism which is more hopeless than pessimism. This optimism which is the very heart of hell. Against such an aching vacuum of joyless approval, there is only one antidote, a sudden and pugnacious belief in positive evil. This world can be made beautiful again by beholding it as a battlefield. When we have defined and isolated the evil thing, the colors come back into everything else. When evil things have become evil, good things in a blazing apocalypse become good. There are some men who are dreary because they do not believe in God, but there are many others who are dreary because they do not believe in the devil. The grass grows green again when we believe in the devil. The roses grow red again when we believe in the devil. No man was more filled with the sense of this bellicose basis of all cheerfulness than Dickens. He knew very well the essential truth that the true optimist can only continue as an optimist so long as he is discontented. for the full value of this life can only be got by fighting, the violent take it by storm. And if we have accepted everything, we have missed something, war. This life of ours is a very enjoyable fight, but a very miserable truce. And it appears strange to me that so few critics of Dickens or of other romantic writers have noticed this philosophical meaning in the undiluted villain. The villain is not in the story to be a character. He is there to be a danger, a ceaseless, ruthless, and uncompromising menace like that of wild beasts of the sea. For the full satisfaction of the sense of combat, which everywhere and always involves a sense of equality, it is necessary to make the evil thing a man. But it is not always necessary, it is not even always artistic, to make him a mixed and probable man. In any tale, the tone of which is at all symbolic, he may quite legitimately be made an aboriginal and infernal energy. He must be a man only in the sense that he must have a wit and will to be matched with a wit and will of the man chiefly fighting. The evil may be inhuman, but it must not be impersonal, which is almost exactly the opposite occupied by Satan in the theological scheme. But when all is said, as I have remarked before, the chief fountain in Dickens of what I have called cheerfulness, and some prefer to call optimism, is something deeper than a verbal philosophy. It is, after all, an incomparable hunger and pleasure for the vitality and the variety, for the infinite eccentricity of existence. And this word eccentricity brings us perhaps nearer to the matter than any other. It is perhaps the strongest mark of the divinity of man that he talks of this world as a strange world, though he has seen no other. We feel that all there is eccentric, though we do not know what is the center. This sentiment of the grotesqueness of the universe ran through Dickens's brain and body like the mad blood of the elves. He saw all his streets in fantastic perspectives. He saw all his Cockney villas as top-heavy and wild. He saw every man's nose twice as big as it was, and every man's eyes like saucers. And this was the basis of his gaiety, the only real basis of any philosophical gaiety. This world is not to be justified, as it is justified by the mechanical optimists. It is not to be justified as the best of all possible worlds. Its merit is not that it is orderly and explicable. Its merit is that it is wild and utterly unexplained. Its merit is precisely that none of us could have conceived such a thing, that we should have rejected the bare idea of it as miracle and unreason. It is the best of all impossible worlds. End of chapter 11. Recording by Dick Durrett, Manchester, New Hampshire, USA.
Chapter 12 of Charles Dickens. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Lucy Burgoyne. Charles Dickens by G.K. Chesterton. Chapter 12. A Note on the Future of Dickens. The hardest thing to remember about our own time, of course, is simply that it is a time. We all instinctively think of it as the day of judgment, but all the things in it which belong to it merely as this time will probably be rapidly turned upside down. All the things that can pass will pass. It is not merely true that all old things are already dead. It is also true that all things are already dead, for the only undying things are the things that are neither new nor old. The more you are up with the year's fashion, the more, in a sense, you are already behind next year's. Consequently, in attempting to decide whether an author will, as it is cantly expressed, live, it is necessary to have very firm convictions about what part, if any part, of man is unchangeable. And it is very hard to have this if you have not a religion or, at least, a dogmatic philosophy. The equality of men needs preaching quite as much as regards the ages as regards the classes of men. To feel infinitely superior to a man in the 12th century is just precisely as snobbish as to feel infinitely superior to a man in the Old Kent Road. There are differences between the man and us. There may be superiorities in us over the man, but our sin in both cases consists in thinking of the small things wherein we differ, when we ought to be confounded and intoxicated by the terrible and joyful matters in which we are at one. But here again the difficulty always is that the things near us seem larger than they are, and so seem to be a permanent part of mankind, when they may really be only one of its parting modes of expression. Few people, for instance, realize that a time may easily come when we shall see the great outburst of science in the 19th century as something quite as splendid, brief, unique, and ultimately abandoned as the outburst of art at the Renaissance. Few people realize that the general habit of fiction, of telling tales in prose, may fade, like the general habit of the ballad, of telling tales in verse, has for the time faded. Few people realize that reading and writing are only arbitrary, and perhaps temporary sciences, like heraldry. The immortal mind will remain, and by that writers like Dickens will be securely judged. That Dickens will have a high place in permanent literature there is, I imagine, no prig surviving to deny. But though all prediction is in the dark, I would devote this chapter to suggesting that his place in 19th century England will not only be high, but altogether the highest. At a certain period of his contemporary fame, an average Englishman would have said that there were, at that moment in England, about 5 or 6 able and equal novelists. He could have made a list: Dickens, Bulwer Lytton, Thackeray, Charlotte Bronte, George Eliot, perhaps more. 40 years or more have passed, and some of them have slipped to a lower place. Some would now say that the highest platform is left to Thackeray and Dickens. Some to Dickens, Thackeray and George Eliot. Some to Dickens, Thackeray and Charlotte Bronte. I venture to offer the proposition that when more years have passed and more weeding has been effected, Dickens will dominate the whole England of the 19th century. He will be left on that platform alone. I know that this is an almost impertinent thing to assert, and that its tendency is to bring in those disparaging discussions of other writers in which Mr. Swinburne brilliantly embroiled himself in his suggestive study of Dickens. But my disparagement of the other English novelists is wholly relative and not in the least positive. it is certain that men will always return to such a writer as Thackeray, with his rich emotional autumn, his feeling that life is a sad but sacred retrospect, in which at least we should forget nothing. It is not likely that wise men will forget him. So, for instance, wise and scholarly men do from time to time return to the lyrists of French Renaissance, to the delicate poignancy of Du Bellay. So they will go back to Thackeray. But I mean that Dickens will bestride and dominate our time, as the vast figure of Rabelais dominates Du Bellay, dominates the Renaissance and the world. Let me put a negative reason first, the particular thing for which Dickens is condemned, and justly condemned, by his critics, are precisely those things which have never prevented a man from being immortal. The chief of them is the unquestionable fact that he wrote an enormous amount of bad work. This does lead to a man being put below his place in his own time. It does not affect his permanent place, to all appearance, at all. Shakespeare, for instance, and Wordsworth wrote not only an enormous amount of bad work, but an enormous amount of enormously bad work. Humanity edits such writers' works for them. Virgil was mistaken in cutting out his inferior lines. We would have undertaken the job. Moreover, in the particular case of Dickens, there are special reasons for regarding his bad work, as I have previously suggested, under a kind of general ambition that had nothing to do with his special genius, an ambition to be a public provider of everything, a warehouse of all human emotions. He held a kind of literary day of judgment. He distributed bad characters as punishments, and good characters as rewards. My meaning can be best conveyed by one instance out of many, the character of the kind old Jew in Our Mutual Friend. A needless and unconvincing character was actually introduced because some Jewish correspondent complains that the bad old Jew in Oliver Twist conveyed the suggestion that all Jews were bad. The principle is so light-headedly absurd that it is hard to imagine any literary man submitting to it for an instant. If ever he invented a bad auctioneer, he must immediately balance him with a good auctioneer. If he should have conceived an unkind philanthropist, he must, on the spot, with whatever natural agony and toil, imagine a kind philanthropist. The complaint is frantic, yet Dickens, who tore people in pieces for much fairer complaints, like this complaint of his Jewish correspondent. It pleased him to be mistaken for a public arbiter. It pleased him to be asked, in a double sense, to judge Israel. All this is so much another thing, a non-literary vanity, and there is much less difficulty than usual in separating it from his serious genius, and by his serious genius, I need hardly say, I mean his comic genius. Such irrelevant ambitions as this are easily passed over, like the sonnets of great statesmen. We feel that such things can be set aside, as the ignorant experiments of men otherwise great, like the politics of Professor Tyndall, or the philosophy of Professor Haeckel. Hence, I think, posterity will not care that Dickens has done bad work, but will know that he has done good. Again, the other chief accusation against Dickens was that his characters and their actions were exaggerated and impossible. But this only meant that they were exaggerated and impossible as compared with the modern world and with certain writers, like Thackeray or Trollope, who were making a very exact copy of the manners of the modern world. Some people, oddly enough, have suggested that Dickens has suffered or will suffer from the change of manners. Surely this is irrational. It is not the creators of the impossible who will suffer from the process of time. Mr. Bunsby can never be any more impossible than he was when Dickens made him. The writers who will obviously suffer from time will be the careful and realistic writers, the writers who have observed every detail of the fashion of this world which passeth away. It is surely obvious that there is nothing so fragile as a fact, that a fact flies away quicker than a fancy. A fancy will endure for 2,000 years. For instance, we all have fancy for an entirely fearless man, a hero, and the Achilles of Homer still remains. But exactly the thing we do not know about Achilles is how far he was possible. The realistic narrators of the time are all forgotten, thank God. So we cannot tell whether Homer slightly exaggerated or wildly exaggerated or did not exaggerate at all. The personal activity of a Mercenaean captain in battle, for the fancy has survived the facts. So the fancy of Podsnap may survive the facts of English commerce, and no one will know whether Podsnap was possible, but only know that he is desirable, like Achilles. The positive argument for the permanence of Dickens comes back to the thing that can only be stated and cannot be discussed, creation. He made things which nobody else could possibly make. He made Dick Swiveller in a very different sense from that in which Thackeray made Colonel Newcome. Thackeray's creation was observation. Dickens was poetry, and is therefore permanent. But there is one other test that can be added. The immortal writer, I conceive, is commonly he who does something universal in a special manner. I mean that he does something interesting to all men in a way in which only one man or one land can do. Other men in that land who do only what other men in other lands are doing as well tend to have a great reputation in their day and to sink slowly into a second or third or a fourth place. A parallel from war will make the point clear. I cannot think that anyone will doubt that, although Wellington and Nelson were always bracketed. Nelson will steadily become more important and Wellington less. For the fame of Wellington rests upon the fact that he was a good soldier in the service of England, exactly as 20 similar men were good soldiers in the service of Austria or Prussia or France. But Nelson is the symbol of a special mode of attack, which is at once universal and yet especially English, the sea. Now Dickens is at once as universal as the sea and as English as Nelson. Thackeray and George Eliot and the other great figures of that great England were comparable to Wellington in this, that the kind of thing they were doing, realism, the acute study of intellectual things, numerous men in France, Germany, and Italy were doing as well or better than they. But Dickens was really doing something universal, yet something that no one but an Englishman could do. This is attested by the fact that he and Byron are the men who, like pinnacles, strike the eye of the continent. The points would take long to study, yet they may take only a moment to indicate. No one but an Englishman could have filled his books at once with a furious caricature, and with a positively furious kindness. In more central countries, full of cruel memories of political change, caricature is always inhumane. No one but an Englishman could have described the democracy as consisting of free men, but yet of funny men. In other countries where the democratic issue has been more bitterly fought, it is felt that unless you describe a man as dignified, you are describing him as a slave. This is the only final greatness of a man, that he does for all the world what all the world cannot do for itself. Dickens, I believe, did it. The hour of absinthe is over. We shall not be much further troubled with the little artist who found Dickens too sane for their sorrows and too clean for their delights. But we have a long way to travel before we get back to what Dickens meant. And the passage is along a rambling English road, a twisting road such as Mr. Pickwick travelled. But this, at least, is part of what he meant, that comradeship and serious joy are not interludes in our travel, but that rather our travels are interludes in comradeship and joy, which through God shall endure for ever. The inn does not point to the road points to the inn, and all roads point at last to an ultimate inn, where we shall meet Dickens and all his characters, and when we drink again it shall be from the great flagons in the tavern at the end of the world. End of chapter 12. End of Charles Dickens by G.K. Chesterton.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.